From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South. Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Jamie Lou? Do y'all like Jamie Lou? Indie folk singer-songwriter Jamie Lou lives in Northwest Arkansas. Among other accolades, Jamie Lou won the 2012 songwriting competition at the Yonder Mountain Harvest Music Festival. She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And our new set back here, what do y'all think about our set? Y'all like our set? Our set includes the artwork of V.L. Cox, and we now do a featured artist each month, and this month is painter Doug Norton, and our featured piece tonight is this piece here of legendary jazz singer Billie Holiday, right here. What do y'all think? Y'all like this? These pieces are for sale, and our listeners can go to our website and find out more about the artwork as well as our featured artist tonight, Doug Norton, on our website, which is talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week, our writers all take us back in time as our stories are all set in the South in the 1930s and 40s. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Shervina Grubbs and her sister go on a summer trip in 1938. And then Mary Button goes to see a president on a train tour the same year. And we'll end the night in 1942 with Catherine King, her mother, and an unfortunate snake. But let's start the night with Pat Corcoran as she gets ready for church in 1945 in Sunday Prayer.
Sitting in the middle of my parents' feather bed, I was admiring the new dress Mama had made for me to wear on this special Sunday in 1945. I was almost 4 years old. My dress had been made from the scraps of the one Mama had sewn for herself. When Mama and Daddy married, they joined a strict Pentecostal church up on Crow Mountain near Russellville, Arkansas. The women of this church all dressed the way we see women dressed in the cults today when the federal agents raid their compounds. Their dresses were not stylish. Their hair was usually worn up in a bun or rolled back off their faces. They wore absolutely no makeup. This went against all that was my mother. As a teenager, my mother loved fashion and spent hours on her makeup and hair, which was cut in a fashionable bob of that era. But that was her childhood. We must now return to the days of mine. Sunday was the day we dressed up and went to church. We went every Sunday morning and stayed for Sunday afternoon singing and dinner on the ground. Sunday nights, Wednesday and Friday nights were church nights, unless there was a revival going on. In that case, add Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday nights. But I was telling you about my little navy blue crepe dress. It had three tiny pink buttons on the bodice. My dress fell just a couple of inches above my knees. It covered the bruises on my legs if I held it close to me. Even at that age, I'd learned to hide the bruises. Mama had made me a new dress for this particular Sunday because there was going to be a special prayer service for me. I had started having asthma, and it was getting worse. I was anxious and scared about this prayer service because I didn't want the preacher to pray for me. I didn't even like going to church, and I didn't believe his prayer was going to help me. The preacher had said if I didn't believe, God wouldn't heal me. So I suppose I was already a goner. When one of us children was singled out for any reason, it was a bad thing. We would begin to cry and tremble. We were never singled out for anything good. Fear began building as Mama dressed me and combed my hair. The night before, she had rolled my hair up on socks. She rolled it up while it was still wet so it would curl better. She now carefully unrolled the socks, leaving a long curl where each sock had been. The result was a head full of long, dangling, dark curls. I sound adorable, though my mother forever saw great evil in me. I hoped Mama didn't know what I was thinking. She was already looking at me as though she wanted to hit me again. If she knew I didn't have faith in the preacher's ability to have God heal me, I would get the belt. It was an uncomfortable car ride to the church. Well, uncomfortable is a benign word when referring to my state of mind when in the presence of my parents. Anytime we were forced to be in close proximity to our parents, we were overwhelmed with fear. Since the attention was being directed toward me, I was terrified. The church service had arrived at that point in time for the preacher to announce that I was the object of this Sunday morning's special prayer. That familiar feeling of blind panic took over, and I had to fight the urge to run. I was always thinking about running away. It was never going to happen because I knew the consequences when I would inevitably be caught. That was sufficient reason for me to sit still and be quiet. The preacher called us up to the front of the church. My daddy picked me up and sat me on the altar. Everything became very quiet, except my heart, which was beating fast, hard, and much too loud. The preacher took a small bottle of what he referred to as holy oil from the pulpit and put a little of it on his finger, then touched my forehead. Suddenly, all hell broke loose. He grabbed my head with both hands and started yelling and shaking my head. That's the way Pentecostal preachers prayed. They yelled. As soon as I saw the bottle of oil up close, I recognized the shape. It was olive oil. When the preacher's hand got close to me, the smell of it confirmed my suspicions. We had that stuff at home, and it couldn't heal anything. Mama heated it up to give her hair a hot oil treatment. My mama and daddy were standing beside the preacher as he started his loud praying. They were being quiet and had their eyes closed. This was the preacher's show. I wished he would stop yelling and shaking my head, which was beginning to hurt. I sat very still, making tight little fists as I waited for the yelling to stop. I had discovered this coping mechanism the hard way. I was embarrassed to be on display and wanted to go somewhere and hide. There was always the danger that I would unwittingly do something that would ensure that I get the living hell beat out of me. Being on display almost guaranteed it would happen. The more I tried to behave myself, the more trouble I seemed to get into. I knew Mama and Daddy blamed me for having asthma. Maybe the preacher was angry with me also. Finally, my part of the show was over. The preacher stopped yelling and shaking my head. He helped me down off the altar. I followed Mama and Daddy as we traipsed back to our pew and prepared for another hour and a half of yelling and shouting by the preacher. Only now, the parishioners would be able to join in. As I sat by my daddy, I could feel my chest tightening as I breathed. Perhaps my asthma would worsen, as I had been an unwilling participant in this prayer service. So there I sat, barely 4 years old, and already I disliked church, and I did not believe that God was listening to that loud, angry man who prayed for me. My breathing became even more difficult as the shouting of the congregation became louder. I stared down at my little tight fist, realizing I'd sealed my own fate with my stubborn, rebellious disbelief.
Pat Corcoran, born at the foot of Crow Mountain in Pope County, Arkansas, is one of eight children. Her first novel, Mama, You're Crazy, co-written with her daughter, Ashley Corcoran Weiss, was published in 2010. In our next story, Shervina Grubbs and her twin sister get an eyeful in Peeping Around the Sheets.
Sister? Did you hear that? Oh, I hope Mother and Daddy will let us go. Rabina said to me as we knelt behind the counter at our parents' general store in Russellville, Arkansas. Maybe, maybe, I said to my sister, fingers pressed to my lips. The summer of 1938 started out, like all of our summers, great. Seven-year-old twins, Shervina and Rabina, we had just finished the second grade. There was no kindergarten in 1930. Mother had started us at 5 1/2 because she was expecting a baby and wanted us out of the house. We were so excited. Our Uncle Fred, Daddy's only brother, and Aunt Jeanette had asked Mother and Daddy if we could spend the summer with them on top of Mount Nebo, about an hour's drive from our home. Our uncle and aunt had no children, so we were sort of special that we were identical twins. The talk continued, then Daddy said, Fred, ask Melvina, our mother. She'll have to make the decision. Well, it was a little iffy, because when we were at their house visiting for a while, Aunt Jeanette always seemed to get a bad headache. We just didn't understand why. Mother finally agreed to let us go to Mount Nebo. Oh, sister, did you hear that? We're going. We were so excited we started asking, when are we leaving? Are we leaving now? When, Daddy, when? We almost talked our folks to death. But the day finally came when we started up the mountain. We were quiet going up the curvy road. We could hear the crunch of the gravel, and it made a lot of noise. Uncle Fred's car, a beautiful maroon Buick, just hummed all the way to the top. We had a log cabin and our own bedroom, and big rocks on the edge of the rim that we could sit on and see the sunrise and the sunset. It didn't take us long to get to know all the neighbors. Evenings were really good times because Aunt Jeanette and Uncle Fred taught us how to play Chinese checkers and plain old checkers. We played and played until they would have to call it a night. And we would do the very same thing the next night. During the days, we walked around the rim on the way to the little grocery store to pick up something for Aunt Jeanette. One day, we came to a big rock chair right on the rim. Sister, let's get in this chair. Okay, said Rabina. We sat there and we looked up at the sky, and I said, you know, sister, I bet this is God's chair because it's so close to heaven. We would always go a different way so we didn't miss anything. We saw lots of animals and lots of little baby snakes. We were fearless, but we sure ran that there pretty fast. Then came the day when we saw some sheets hung up around the big rocks. Do you think we should see what it is, sister? I asked Rabina. Yes, yes. So we did. We peeped around the sheets, and guess what? It was naked sunbathers. We ran to the cabin and told Aunt Jeanette. Unfortunately, that was the end of our peeping around the sheets. It seemed a short summer. Our folks drove up the mountain to pick us up, and we said our goodbyes. I looked at Rabina. I don't think Aunt Jeanette had a headache this summer, do you? Sister, Rabina replied, she had so much fun. I guess she forgot to have one.
Shervina Thompson Grubbs resides in Hot Springs, Arkansas, where she, along with her twin sister Rabina, part of the Cry Likey Realtors twin team. Shervina was born in Little Rock but grew up in Russellville. She and her sister were the first majorettes after World War II for Arkansas Tech. Next, it's a hot Texas day in the 30s when Mary Button goes to see a president and a first lady in A Small Sacrifice.
My aunt drove us to the depot an hour and a half before the train's scheduled arrival time. She had to park the car many blocks away. I was 11, and we joined the throng of hundreds of people milling about, moving ever closer to the section of the tracks where they imagined the train would likely stop. The train was half an hour late, but this did not diminish the size of the crowd waiting in the hot Texas sun. As the train rolled in and came to a stop, the crowd pushed forward with increased momentum. In addition to feeling almost smothered by the press of the people, I became aware that I was moving, but my feet were not touching the ground. The crowd of people was propelling me forward. Eventually, the crowd was stopped. President Franklin D. Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt appeared at the back of the train, waving, and a little girl presented Eleanor with an armful of roses. I had spent much of the summer of 1936 at my grandmother's house in Denison, Texas. Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were making a cross-country trip via train. Some of the city officials, no doubt staunch Democrats, prevailed upon the planners of the entourage to make a whistle stop in Denison. The town had been abuzz with the prospects of the presidential visit. When the day came, it was decided that Grandma was not feeling well enough to deal with the heat and the crowds, but my aunt would go to the train station and take my cousin and me. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see a real-life president of the United States. I had no problem deciding what to wear. It would be my dusty rose lace dress with the matching color grosgrain ribbon sash. The Montgomery Ward catalog was a real wish book in our household in the 30s. Shopping opportunities were limited in the small town of Alney, Texas. And besides, prices were cheaper in the catalog than in locally owned stores. Though I was considered to be from a family of wealth by some of my schoolmates because Daddy worked at the bank where all that money was kept, the truth was that my parents struggled to make ends meet on the small salary the bank paid Daddy. Items we ordered from the catalog ranged from lengths of fabric for Mother to sew to kangaroo leather shoes for Daddy, which would enable him to hop like a kangaroo. He almost had us kids convinced. Santa must have had access to the Montgomery catalog also. Come Christmas morning one year, my sister received the doll she had wished for, pictured on page 247 of the catalog. That was the year I got my gold cross necklace found on page 114. The big splurge was the mahogany Duncan Fife dining room furniture, a longtime wish of my mother's. The spring I was 11, we ordered fabric for my Sunday best dress of the season. I was excited by Mother's decision to make the dress of lace. I got to choose the color, dusty rose. It took about 10 days for the order to arrive, and I excitedly dreamed how beautiful the dress would be and how elegant I would look wearing it. When the order arrived, I was a little disappointed in the quality of the fabric. The lace was stiff and coarse looking, and the dusty rose fabric color rather dull. The fabric cut to length was a non-returnable item, so I had to hope the dress would make up pretty. Fortunately, it did seem to improve when it took on the form of the dress. Mother added a 2-inch wide matching grosgrain ribbon for a sash, and that was a nice touch. And it turned out it would be the perfect dress to see a president. Both Franklin and Eleanor said a few words. I was close enough to hear the sound of their voices, but not near enough to differentiate their words. I had heard the president speak on radio. His speech was a little foreign to my southern ears when he said such things as, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." But I had never heard Eleanor speak before and was unprepared for the high-toned shrillness of her voice. I think I had imagined she would speak in soft, dulcet tones. She wasn't very pretty either. I had the notion that, like queens and princesses, the first lady of the land should be beautiful. But pretty or not, even at the age of 11, I recognized her gracious, genteel manner. After a scheduled 20-minute stop, the train whisked the Roosevelts away and the crowd began to disperse. It was then that I noticed my grosgrain ribbon sash was missing, pulled away from my body by the push and shove of the crowd. But I considered the loss of a ribbon sash small sacrifice for the privilege of having seen the President of the United States of America. I had been well-dressed for this most special occasion of my young life. I wore my dusty rose lace dress made by my mother's skilled hands from fabric ordered from the Montgomery Ward catalog.
Mary Button is a native Texan, a transplanted Arkansan, the mother of two adult daughters, a retired elementary school teacher, and a closet poet. In our final story of the night, Catherine King takes us back to the 40s to a day she'll never forget in The Snake and John Paul Duncan's Mother's Funeral.
In my 5-year-old mind, I had a plan. I had seen my sister cough, turn red in the face, and throw up. Mother said she had allergies. I knew I would be red in the face because of the heat, and that if I coughed enough, I might just throw up. It was a hot August day in 1942 when Mother informed my brother, then 10, my 4-year-old sister, and me that we would be attending the funeral of John Paul Duncan's mother, Mrs. Duncan. There were no florist shops within 42 miles of our town, so neighbors and relatives of the deceased would cut flowers from our mother's yard and pick ferns that grew by the cow pond. She knew every time there was going to be a funeral at Jones Cemetery. It's about a quarter of a mile from our house. Not only did she say we would attend Mrs. Duncan's funeral, but that we would walk. We had a car. And I didn't see any sense in all that walking. That road was long and dusty. Our mother was a tall, fair complexion, auburn-haired third-grade teacher, and she did not take any sass from children. I knew what was about to happen. She would dress my sister and me in black patent leather shoes and dresses with matching panties that were hand-sewn from flower sacks. The red inner soles of the shoes caused my feet to burn. It was because they were red, it caused my feet to burn. If that were not bad enough, the dresses and panties would be so stiff with starts they could almost stand alone. She said we were not common folk, and we did not wear rough, dry dresses. All that starch made me itch, which made me fidget, and I knew fidgeting caused me trouble. Before we started the walk, Mother reminded us of the graveyard don'ts. Don't stand on a headstone.
Don't speak ill of the dead or gossip about the deceased. Don't ever step on a grave or peer inside a casket, as there is no virtue in disrespect of the dead. I would surely be happy to be 17 years old so I would know what that word virtue meant. She used that word a lot. The final word, children are to be seen and not heard, and I expect you to behave. When she said you, she pointed her finger at each one of us respectively. Because we were not family, we could not sit under the funeral tent. We would have to sit or stand in the hot sun. If Latimer Funeral Home conducted the service, they would lend fans. The fan had a scene of Jesus sitting on a rock. Didn't they know that Jesus' father was God? Jesus should at least have a rocking chair instead of a rock. The fans didn't help the heat much, but at least I could move my hands if I had a fan. I could foresee a hot, miserable afternoon. Then I came up with a plan to make myself throw up. Mother might not be happy, but if she thought I was sick, I would not get in trouble. My mother even complimented me on being such a big girl and not fussing about going to that funeral. She wasn't aware I was about to be sick. My mother, in a big straw hat, my brother, my sister, and I started to the graveyard. On the way, my brother spotted a big snake crawling up a fence post. We had seen this snake before atop that same post when we drove by the car. My brother said the snake was getting a tan. I really didn't believe that snake got tans, but there it was again. You won't believe what happened next. I can remember the incident, and it happened about 70 years ago. My brother's memory is that mother jumped across the ditch, grabbed the snake with one hand, took a Lash LaRue staunch, and popped his head off with one paw. My memory is that she raised her skirt with both hands, stepped across the ditch, took two steps, and stopped and set her feet. She then grabbed that snake by the tail, swung him around like she was hitting a baseball, and the snake connected with the fence post. She hit the post with such force that the snake wrapped around the post. She stopped, took a deep breath, and started pulling the snake off the post. You could hear bones cracking, see flesh tearing as it was ripped from the bone. She then tossed the snake away from her. The snake was bleeding. My brother was yelling. My sister was crying. And I was just amazed. The poor snake was almost dead, but he wiggled a little. And mother let out a yell like a banshee, grabbed two stones, and hit him dead center with both. She then wiped her hands on the grass, smoothed her clothes, cleared her throat, picked up her hat, and we proceeded to the funeral. Right before we entered the cemetery, Mother reached inside the front of her dress, right between her dinners, and retrieved a lace hanky and wiped the sweat from her upper lip. She acted like nothing happened at all. After that little episode, I was afraid to put my little plan in action. I decided to endure the heat and the long-winded preacher and not make a scene. Miss Ludy started the service singing, "When the roll is called up yonder, when the roll is called up yonder." Mother did not appreciate me asking her if Miss Ludy sang so loud so that those up yonder would know that Miss Duncan was on her way. She even cupped my chin in her hand and hissed hush when I asked her if we were at the right funeral. I thought of that snake hissing and didn't give her any reason for my doubt. That preacher kept calling Mrs. Duncan a saint, but I wasn't sure she was a saint. I had seen pictures of saints in a Bible storybook, and Mrs. Duncan didn't look the part. No saint in that book had black, stiff hair, mean eyes, and red claws at the end of her fingers. Mother, on the other hand, might just be a saint. She had a circle of light around her head like Jesus had in those pictures. It was not a hat, but the word did start with an H. And when the corners of Mother's mouth went up in a smile, it caused her eyes to just drop little bits of love on you. Honest Injun, her hugs were like riding on a cloud. Somewhere between the first hallelujah and the last amen, I changed my mind and decided to be sick. Mother stood a little in front of me, which was good, because I knew she did not have eyes in the back of her head. I had checked that out already while brushing her hair. I sneezed, coughed, and dropped my fan. My mother's head swung around like it was on a swivel. She winked at me and shook her head no and smiled. I knew right then that something I had always suspected was true. My mother could wink and not use both hands. Therefore, I knew she could read my mind. I decided once again not to be sick. On the way home, we all walked on the other side of the road from the snake. My mother, however, picked up a long stick and went across the ditch and punched the snake and advised us that snakes didn't give her any trouble. Neither did we. I thought this day would never end. I was not strong enough to draw water from the well, but my brother was strong enough. He was 10, remember. So after finally getting home, he drew about half a bucket of water for us. After getting a drink of water, we poured the rest on our heads and our feet to cool ourselves. We then headed for the climbing tree. We did not let our baby sister go with us. She's just 4. She was 4 years old and did not understand the deep things that my brother and I did. After discussing the snake thing, we decided we had a mother whose actions spoke louder than words, a mother to remember.
Catherine King was born in rural Arkansas in 1937. She has been married to B.J. King for 57 years. Her 3 goals in life are to be a good wife, a good mother, and to read as many of the old classics as possible. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.